COVID-19 pandemic has made us all more aware of how the spread of disease can impact our daily lives. However, there are many places, particularly in the tropical regions of the world, where the ongoing threat of serious disease is nothing new.
Rising temperatures caused by climate change could allow for diseases like malaria to spread to new regions and areas of the globe. Together with ongoing environmental pressures, we could be looking at an increase in our vulnerability to global pandemics. Are we ready to deal with this looming threat? Hello, and welcome to the Met Aaron podcast. I'm Liz Walsh.
I'm Noel Fitzpatrick, and in this month, we are exploring how climate can influence the spread of disease and how weather may impact the transmission of COVID-19. We're delighted to be joined by Dr. Rachel Lowe, Associate Professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Rachel is also a member of the World Meteorological Organization's expert team on COVID-19, which we'll be discussing a little later in the episode. So thanks so much for joining us today, Rachel. We've been really looking forward to getting stuck into this episode. We're aware of the effects that climate change might have directly on human health. So through things like severe storms or floods or fires, things like that. But there are a whole range of indirect ways that climate can affect health.
Yeah, sure. So climate can affect our health in multiple ways. And one of those ways is providing more suitable conditions for the emergence and re-emergence of new disease vectors and pathogens to areas that previously hadn't seen these.
So you mentioned their disease vectors. So can you just clarify what you mean by that?
Sure. By vector-borne disease, I mean diseases that are spread by a vector, which could be a mosquito or a tick. And these mosquitoes and ticks in particular, they're very sensitive to changes in the temperature, which can affect the biology of these vectors. So particularly mosquitoes that can transmit the arboviral diseases, dengue, chikungunya and Zika. We've seen an expansion of the Aedes albopictus mosquito through southern Europe, for example. And so that increases the chance of being able to establish local transmission of those diseases in Europe, for example. And we have seen some localized outbreaks of dengue and Zika in parts of Europe.
In terms of those sensitivities, are there particular diseases that are highly sensitive to climate? Are there some that you would say that are particularly sensitive?
Well, dengue and malaria are particularly very important mosquito-borne diseases, which are sensitive to changes in the climate. So temperature, sort of up to an optimum point, provides ideal conditions for the mosquitoes to speed up their transmission cycle and also for the pathogens they transmit. Outside of the optimum ranges, it can either be too cool or too hot for transmission. And also we see these sort of non-linear relationships with precipitation as well. For example, when we have too much rainfall, we can disrupt breeding habitats of the mosquitoes. Whereas if we have very dry conditions, drought conditions, this can actually cause additional water storage containers to mitigate the effect of drought. And then that in turn can produce more mosquito breeding sites.
Like, I think a lot of people, they've heard of malaria, but they're and dengue as well. But can you just explain what malaria is?
Absolutely. So malaria is a disease that's caused by Plasmodium parasites. And around 93% of all cases occur in sub-Saharan Africa. And malaria is particularly linked to inequality and poverty. Malaria is transmitted between humans by female Anopheles mosquitoes. They're mainly found in tropical and subtropical areas, although you can find some species at higher latitudes. And the spatial range of malaria is very much related to human interventions over the past five decades. So we have seen some improvements, although recently we've also seen some kind of a reverse of these positive efforts. And we've seen a re-emergence, particularly in Latin America. We've seen a tenfold increase in cases in Venezuela, for example.
In terms of the future projections for malaria under climate change, I mean, you mentioned already that there have been some increases again in Latin America and places like that. How How do we see malaria changing or increasing in the future, assuming that we have some climate change?
Yeah, so according to models based on scenarios of increased emission scenarios, we would expect the suitability, the climate suitability for the transmission of malaria to increase in tropical highlands, particularly in Africa, also in the eastern Mediterranean region and in the Americas. And we also see similar projections for dengue with the sort of epidemic belt for both these diseases expanding towards more temperate areas.
Could we see it here in Ireland?
According to the models, it looks like in Europe, it's more likely in sort of eastern Mediterranean area to have that ideal combination of temperature, precipitation and humidity. And it also really depends on the sort of local socioeconomic conditions for these diseases to establish themselves.
So a lesser known, so you've talked about the lesser known disease there, dengue, which is also spread by mosquitoes. And is that spreading very quickly in the tropics?
Yeah, we've seen a huge global increase in dengue over the last few decades, and it's now endemic in over 120 countries. Right. And the spread is thought to be due to a combination of things, including climate change, but also urbanization, globalization, sort of international travel. So both people spreading the disease around and also mosquitoes being able to reach new places through trade, for example, trade in used tires is one route. So yeah, we've seen it. Dengue is now considered one of the top 10 global health threats by the World Health Organization.
What are the symptoms of dengue? Like, you know, because I know that some people can be asymptomatic, and that's part of the problem of it, really.
Absolutely. So the reported cases we have of dengue is really only the tip of the iceberg, because there's only really those symptomatic cases that then sort of report into the health systems. But there is a huge proportion of asymptomatic people who either have the disease and don't realize it and are able to spread, is able to spread easily that way, or otherwise the sort of subclinical symptoms, and it's never caught by the surveillance systems.
What are the symptoms of dengue?
The symptoms of dengue are sort of severe flu-like symptoms, so fever, aches and pains, or rash. And this can turn into a more severe form of the disease, which can include hemorrhagic dengue fever, for example, which can in some cases be fatal. So it's really important to seek hospital treatment in this case. And when we tend to have epidemics of the disease, then we can really see hospitals being overwhelmed. And sometimes, for example, in Brazil in the past, the military and other services have to be brought in to deal with the sort of overwhelming number of people with dengue, which can result in, you know, a huge socioeconomic burden on society, a big problem in terms of days missed at work. And it also can be very severe in some in children as well.
Rachel, I know you developed a model for the Brazilian World Cup in terms of predicting the, I guess, the levels of transmission during that period. I mean, that must have been an incredibly difficult thing to do, to try and forecast a disease.
Absolutely. So at the time of the World Cup, we were working with the Ministry of Health in Brazil, and there'd been a lot of speculation about what might happen in terms of dengue transmission, given that over 3 million travellers were coming into the country. I mean, the games did take place in the Southern Hemisphere winter, when as conditions can be less suitable for the transmission of dengue. But of course, the games took place across a very wide gradient of different climates, because Brazil is a very large country. We had, from previous research, we'd established a probabilistic model combining climate conditions with socioeconomic conditions. So then we had the opportunity to put our model into practice. So we combined seasonal climate forecasts for temperature and precipitation, which were put together by the climate services in Brazil. So they were to forecast the climate conditions just in the months preceding the games. And we combined that with the surveillance cases, the reported dengue cases at the time of our forecast. And that allowed us to produce a probabilistic forecast 3 months ahead of the games.
That's fantastic. And were you able to go back after the games and, you know, evaluate how well the model had performed?
Yes, we were. So after afterwards, we were able to access the reported cases during the month that we predicted. And we found that our model did substantially better than a model based on seasonal averages, which is usually the way that epidemics are tracked by following what's called the endemic channel, which is just the mean of the historic cases, if you like, over the last few years. So using a climate-informed model, we were able to provide more predictive ability to the model than just relying on those seasonal averages alone.
That's fantastic. And obviously, we're talking about different timescales here, but would the fact that you've got, you know, good performance from a model like that give you confidence then when you're looking at longer timescales for these predictions for disease behavior on a, you know, on a climate change timescale?
Yes, we have also been having a look at combining climate change scenarios with socioeconomic scenarios as well. So looking at sort of a range of emission scenarios, from making a lot of effort to mitigate the impacts of climate change to business as usual, and also combining that with different projections of population density, for example. And in those models, we've particularly been trying to understand how the length of the transmission season might change, and also trying to estimate the population at risk in different parts of the globe.
Wow. that just sounds so interesting. So what were the type of things that, from the climate perspective, were you kind of investigating when you're building that model? Was it was it El Nino that you were concentrating on, or like what the situation was with El Nino and other climate factors as to whether, you know, you had tropical waves going through? And obviously it was what you mentioned, it was the time of year. So
when we have El Nino events, we tend to have improved seasonal climate forecasts. They tend to work particularly well in certain parts of the globe. So there's areas that are more connected to the what's going on in the Pacific Ocean. So when we have a warming of the Pacific Ocean, we tend to see anomalous temperature or precipitation events in different places. And one place that's particularly sensitive to El Nino events is the coastal area of Ecuador. And we've been working there with colleagues in the health services there. And we developed a dengue prediction model in that area using El Nino and also anomalies in temperature and precipitation. And we found that following the 2016 El Nino, which was one of the largest events on record, we found that event helped improve the seasonal forecasts for that season. And it was actually, the seasonal forecasts were able to detect a very large flooding event, which happened in the city of Machala, just following that El Nino event. And we also had anomalous temperature conditions. And we were able to combine forecasts of the precipitation and temperature conditions with El Nino and predict the evolution of the dengue season in 2016. And our model was able to detect an early peak in dengue compared to using the seasonal averages. So this was really interesting application of using tracking El Nino and understanding how that impacts the seasonal climate forecast to help us understand the timing and intensity of the dengue season.
So that's a really exciting thing from a meteorological perspective, that we are seeing direct impacts from improvements in weather forecasting techniques and seasonal forecasting directly helping to build health and disease forecast models to aid people in these disadvantaged areas of the world. Because it's not a problem that these populations living in these areas get bad weather. It's also the fact that these areas simply don't have the infrastructure in place to help them deal with the impacts of that weather. We know, for example, that drought increases malaria outbreaks, which is kind of counterintuitive because mosquitoes like warm, wet conditions. But it's how these countries deal with that drought. They get their cheap fix, like water storage containers, because the money to invest in a reliable municipal water supply just isn't available. And then the quick fix solution to the drought or the flood or whatever extreme event it is becomes the breeding ground for those mosquitoes carrying the disease.
Yeah, so when you're in areas with poor environmental hygiene, for example, if you have lots of discarded waste, if you have Water storage containers, for example, that are collecting water, or you can disrupt the fresh water supply, and that can also cause the spread of other waterborne diseases. So that kind of combination of poor environmental hygiene, hydrometeorological hazards, and the ability to sort of quickly address that situation, that can lead to the ideal conditions for an outbreak of a climate-sensitive disease like dengue, or following flooding events, we often see leptospirosis outbreaks as well.
Is that factored into your models then, that kind of the socioeconomic impact as well?
Yeah, so when we're working with spatial data as well, we account for things like level of urbanization, sanitation indicators, to try and understand how that variation is tied in. We've seen in from a recent study that we're seeing that the impact of drought, for example, is exacerbated in urban areas, and particularly areas where we see an increased reportage of water supply interruptions.
And sort of moving away a little bit from the diseases themselves, but you know, we mentioned that with climate change, we may expect more extreme weather events. We might get heavier rainfall here in Ireland and in the UK. We might also expect to see more storms or more flooding. And these, as a secondary effect, will have an increase on the spread of disease, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So extreme weather events can change the timing and intensity of different climate-sensitive diseases. So following floods and hurricanes, for example, we may see more outbreaks of leptospirosis. We can also have a displacement of populations, which could cause people having to gather in shelters, which has implications for the transmission of certain diseases. And also, as we can also see following heavy sort of rainfall events and even drought events, include increases in mosquito-borne disease.
I'd imagine people are also themselves, probably in terms of immune system, maybe are going to be more vulnerable if you have situations where you have food and water shortages, for example, or increased heat stresses due to climate change.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest problems we're seeing with climate change is a reduction in labour capacity and sort of hours lost in labour, particularly subsistence farming. It's having really severe impact on health, like the inability to work, which can also lead to shortages in food and an increase in anxiety. And this is a real problem in terms of parts of the world are just becoming too hot to be able to work outdoors.
You mentioned that some of these diseases may spread into, you know, higher latitudes, but in regions where they're already established, could climate change actually make it too warm for them to succeed? Or could we see a diminishing of these diseases in areas that are already, you know, quite warm?
We could. It's possible that parts of the globe could get too hot for the mosquitoes to be able to efficiently transmit diseases. But I think on balance, if we combine all the climate, all the health impacts of climate change in these places, we'll have a huge negative impact from climate change overall.
Could climate change lead to the development of new diseases or new strains? Because I know that disease or microbes can probably respond quicker, I would imagine, to changes in temperatures than say big mammals like us can.
Yeah, the issue with climate change is it's forcing animals and different species to have to move and migrate to areas where to escape the heat. So these kind of movements can cause different animals to be mixing with each other, and there's more opportunity for pathogens to be exchanged. And then lots of the things that are related to climate change, like, for example, deforestation, which is often take place for agricultural land to be established. All these things mixed together and place humans in closer contact with livestock. And all of this together creates more opportunities for spillover of zoonotic diseases.
That kind of leads into like what you're working on now is with COVID-19. Is COVID-19 affected by the weather?
So that's a really tricky one. So we would expect that, you know, respiratory disease could have some dependency on temperature and humidity. We tend to see, for example, Diseases like influenza and other seasonal coronaviruses, they tend to have show seasonality. They tend to, for example, peak in the cooler winter months in temperate regions. And that's partly due to the impact of temperature and humidity on the virus itself, on our immune systems, and also on how we behave. So, for example, in the colder winter months, we tend to gather more indoors. But at the moment, it's very difficult for us to be able to unpick any weather signatures within the COVID data we have to date. So it's very difficult to tease that apart from the government interventions that have been implemented. So we know that any sort of reduction in social contacts is really what is driving transmission patterns. So as we intensify or relax those measures in different parts of the world, it's very difficult to pick that apart from the seasonal cycle. So at the moment, there's no evidence to suggest that it would be safe to relax measures during warmer months, for example. So at the moment, it's very much any decision based on government intervention should not be related to the meteorological factors at the moment. But we think that as the disease, you know, as immunity builds, as, you know, vaccinations are rolled out, and as this disease becomes established, then we may well see a seasonal cycle in future years.
So in terms of the influence on COVID-19 transmission, it's really more so a combined effect of how people behave in given weather conditions.
Yeah, so there have been some laboratory studies to show that the virus can survive longer under cooler and drier conditions, but we don't know how that plays out in real world conditions, particularly with such intense government interventions. But certainly weather-driven human behaviour will have a huge impact. But of course, it's not clear-cut how that will play out, because often, you know, very cold conditions, people gather indoors, but also when we have extremely hot conditions with air conditioning, that can also cause a lot of indoor transmission.
I guess COVID-19 has made us all more aware of disease, you know, not just individually, but also on a societal level and on a government level. Do you think that could possibly be a positive in the future when it comes to being aware of and preparing for and tackling diseases that may increase due to climate change?
I certainly hope this is a wake up to the international community and to governments to really invest in. We really need to move from a reaction to a prevention framework. We need to be ready for the next pandemic. We need to be able to slow the spread of these diseases due to climate change. And we really need to shift our efforts to be able to build resilience and prevent these outbreaks from happening in the first place.
So in terms of travel restrictions, we are familiar with the travel restrictions we're all living under at the moment. Is that something that could become more common as climate-related diseases increase in different regions of the world?
I think it's going to be really important to be able to have a better understanding of the way the movement of travellers, and understanding the health conditions of travellers, and being able to record that and have a better chance of being able to detect outbreaks. And understand, for example, by sort of increasing the way we monitor the health of travellers, we can better understand where a disease might be emerging, and maybe take measures to, for example, protect travellers on flights or taking international travel.
I suppose, we've heard about the spectre of climate change and how that's going to increase the risk of disease. But can we avoid the worst effects at this stage, do you think, Rachel?
I think it's never too late to act. There's so many things we can do to reduce our carbon footprint, to live a more sustainable lifestyle. Many things not only to do with the way we travel, like shifting to more active forms of travel, but also our consumption patterns, consuming less red meat and animal-derived products, thinking about our fashion choices. There are so many actions that we can take as individuals, and we also need to be putting pressure on governments to take action to really meet those Paris Agreement goals and to reduce the carbon footprint of the most particularly those nations that have contributed to the worst problems.
Well, I think those are good words to live by, and we could all take a lot from that. So thank you so much for that, Rachel. It was a really, really interesting conversation, and certainly learned a lot. And we look forward to hopefully being able to travel in the future, but also keeping these developments in mind. So thank you again.
Pleasure.
I guess it's a good sign that we are beginning to take climate change more seriously. We had the approval of the final text of the climate bill recently passed by government, and that's looking to ensure that we achieve net zero emissions by 2050.
Yeah, it's pretty timely, I suppose, given what we've just talked about. Pretty ambitious as well, because we're looking at a 51% reduction in 2018 level carbon emissions by 2030. Interesting to see how we get on with that, but it's obviously pretty important that we do take action after what Rachel has said and what we discussed there.
Yeah, for sure. It's good to have a definite plan in place and definite goals and milestones that we have to reach. But as you say, that 2030 target is a dramatic reduction. So here's hoping we can stick to that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty inspiring, like, you know, what Rachel said about kind of the individual as well can do things to help here, like, you know, about being proactive about like where you get your clothes from, taking the bike instead of the car, that kind of thing. We all have our part to play.
Absolutely. There's a good individual role, but also then acknowledging to have the widespread systemic change that we need, it has to have government backing.
Definitely. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Our thanks again to Dr. Lowe for joining us this month and helping us to understand the links between climate, weather and disease. Feel free to get in touch on the Met Éireann or RTE Weather social channels, or by emailing us at podcast@met.ie or weather@rte.ie.
Thanks for tuning in. We'd love to have you on board this season, so be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and do check out our previous episodes. We'll be releasing new episodes on the last Thursday of every month. So until next time, thanks for listening and take care.
The Met Éireann podcast was researched and presented by Dr. Noel Fitzpatrick and Liz Walsh. Production and editing is by Jannie Lanrone.